very much sought for the introduction and for striking the note on which this meeting will proceed. Now, we are, as you may have noticed, starting late this morning. Exactly how late is a matter of opinion. We are certainly starting approximately 47 minutes late, but it can be argued that our lateness is much greater than that. Some would say 10, 12, 15 years late. We are also late in the sense that in one sense, when the discussion for this meeting today originated, it was conceived, at least as I recall, I conceived of it, as an Aseret-Shimei Teshuva conference. It occurred to me that Aseret-Shimei Teshuva would be a very good time to institute an annual New York meeting at which the Torah community of New York annually asked itself the question, where have we gone wrong this year? We all hear a great deal of talk about Teshuva, and much of it is, of course, vital and important, but very often the discussion stays on a highly theoretical level and simply refuses to make the connection with the real world in which we live. And if Teshuva is to mean anything, it has to deal not only with general abstractions, but must also deal with the realities of your life and mine, and with the realities of the life of the Jewish community. Our general atmosphere today is devoted to avoiding two extremes. The one I have already briefly alluded to, at least at this morning's session, namely a general discussion of Jewish morality, for which I assume we all are. I don't think there'd be anybody in this room who would come out against morality or against Jewish morality. So we are not here at this session to speak about that in a totally abstract, philosophic, halakhic way. On the other hand, we also wish to avoid the other extreme, which is over-specificity. We cannot here, in the context of this kind of meeting, discuss specific issues, specific cases, for the simple reason that requires a proper forum, it requires a pro and con type of presentation, and it might, in certain instances, prejudice some proceedings which are in progress in other places and in other forums. So therefore, we know what we want to avoid. We want to avoid total generality, the kind of thing where people come out for motherhood and the country, and we want to avoid over-specificity. On the other hand, we want to talk about the real problems which beset the Jewish community. Now, what are these? And I'll just very briefly talk to them, and then I will introduce the members of the panel, and then we will proceed from that point on. Well, it seems to me one of the problems is that orthodoxy in this country has taken on a very great degree of visibility, a degree of visibility that it has not had in the past. And with that, of course, go problems. Because whenever someone is identified as an Orthodox Jew, whatever he does is credited to, or, chas v'sholom, debted to, the whole Jewish community. This is the concept of Kiddush Hashem and Chilul Hashem. The Jewish people is the family of God. And just as in the family situation, particularly this is true among peoples of the Mediterranean area, every member of the family personally feels the glory and the shame of what happens to other members of his family. Because the Jewish people is the family of God, whatever the Jewish people do that is right redounds to the glory of God. And whatever the Jewish people or individuals of that people do that is wrong redounds, cuts the shalom, to the disgrace of God, and that is chilul Hashem. So therefore the problem is with the higher, greater visibility of Orthodox Judaism and the implications of that for the welfare of the Jewish community as a whole, and as Rabbi Berman points out, for God, because the fate of God and the Jewish community in the historic world are tied together very intimately. There is also the problem which has been with Judaism for a long time. There are those mitzvot that are specifically Jewish, kashrus, tzitzis, shatnas, and so on. And then there are those mitzvot that you might say are not specifically Jewish. The general vital mitzvahs of morality and of ethics. For some reason, and perhaps understandably so, our people or a segment of it has come to specialize in the Jewish mitzvahs. There is such a thing as glatt kosher, but there is not, at least I haven't heard, of the concept of glatt ethics.
Glatt yosher.
Glatt ethics.
Glatt yosher.
Glatt yosher. Exactly. And it is perhaps the possibility of developing a fanatical group in that direction that we are trying to investigate today. Members of the panel are three distinguished speakers. First speaker will be Professor Marvin Schick, who is professor of political science at the New School for Social Research, and who was administrative assistant to the mayor in the administration of Mayor Lindy. Professor Schick will lead off the discussion, followed by Rabbi Riskin and Mr. Nat Lewin. Professor Schick.
Thank you, Professor Wishenrad, distinguished colleagues on the panel and to my left, and distinguished audience. I've been asked to lead off the discussion and to talk about various communal aspects of American Orthodox Jewish life which contribute in one way or another to our present ethical situation. In doing so, I'd like to suggest at the outset that the problems that we shall consider today are far from unique, although there is an interesting question as to whether we have now reached a certain intensity of conduct which suggests such a great difference in degree that we have a difference in kind. But generally, since we are all bus of dumb and we are given to various impulses, I think that it is fair enough to recognize that unethical impulses exist at all times, and I suppose in all societies, including ours. The other day, I was looking at a marshor in Sudis, which is located on Daf Samach Zayin, and it's a remarkable marshor because in it, he complains bitterly about the practice in which people who get money through illicit means, purchase their mishaberes, get covered in the community and the shuls, and they are regarded as our most esteemed citizens. That was about 400 years ago, at a time when I suppose whatever the moral standards of the general outside community, we would have hoped and expected that our own standards were very high. Still, no matter what the past and no matter what the inevitable fall from grace, we must consider where we are at today and what we might be able to do about it. And as I said, I am going to deal briefly with the communal aspects. And here there are two points which might be delved into. The first is the general community, American society. I will not add to what Rabbi Berman said in his introductory remarks about Watergate and the atmosphere of American life, its corruption, illicitness, promiscuity of one kind and another. But I think there is one part of the general American scene which influences considerably the trends within the Orthodox community, and which to a great degree account for where we're at today. We are now in the first year or so of the second decade of the Great Society. And without going into the history of the Great Society, or even considering in any fashion its worth in American life, we have to understand that it did fashion several very crucial changes in the relationship between government and people, which had impacted on the Jewish people and especially on the Orthodox Jewish community. For virtually all of American history, and especially since the enactment of Social Security legislation in the 1930s, the notion of public service and social service in the United States was predicated on the idea of individual entitlement. That is, whether we were talking about public hospitals, or public schools, or old age benefits, or age-dependent children, or any other benefit in American life, individuals were the recipients, and they were the recipients in ways which were rather clearly spelled out according to law. And while no doubt people cheated, the law itself did not open up very many opportunities to cheat, and the law did not certainly provide for wholesale inducement for dishonesty. The Great Society changed that in two ways. In the first place, for reasons that related to the fact that it was discovered in the early 1960s that poverty was not eradicated despite a generation of New Deal, Field Deal programs, legislation, etc. Many of the government programs, and certainly the new ones, went away from the notion of individual entitlement and toward the notion of group entitlement. Community action in the field of daycare and other preschool programs, in the field of senior care, in the field of job training, many educational programs, higher educational programs, etc. Individuals as such not only were not encouraged to apply, but they could not apply. You cannot go to a federal office and ask for job training and such. You can't ask for child care. You cannot ask for special remediation in education. You cannot ask for entree into a senior center, so on and so forth. A group applied for you, and presumably the group was the sponsor, and then on the basis of its recipiency of government funds, provided the services to individuals. And the group that government focused on inevitably was the ethnic group, given the background of black militancy and black need, and then the need of Spanish-speaking people. The government went away from the notion of the individual to the notion of the group. There are immense philosophical and moral implications in this, which I will not go into. Perhaps Professor Wishenbrad, who is certainly far abler in that area than I am, would like to explore them in the course of the ensuing discussion. But what happened was that this process of group ultimately, in the the late 1960s and early 1970s filtered down to the Orthodox Jewish community, which in one way or another had the closest nexus with Jewish poverty in various deteriorated neighborhoods, and in the same way that others were making demands for services, the group called Orthodox Jewry was making demands for services. And the same way, ultimately, that other groups exploited these programs illicitly, our people, and certainly many of them, followed what already had been, in a short period of time, a well-trodden path. Secondly, even in the area where government expanded individual entitlement, food stamps, Medicaid, etc., the government adopted, as perhaps it had to, various standards of eligibility, which were wishy-washy, which indeed promoted the notion that individuals, in order to get benefits, would have to be of one degree or another less than honest about where their, what their bank accounts consisted of and what their needs were. And if you attend any institution of higher education, or you know the Medicaid scene, particularly in New York or also elsewhere, you know what I'm talking about. Now, one can argue that the individual immorality was a reciprocal immorality to what government was doing. After all, if a person has $4,000 and is on the brink of poverty, and given the state of medical costs, why should the individual have to go totally broke, utilize virtually all of your resources, hard-earned, hard-saved, in order to get a benefit which society should offer? And those are considerations. But what we must understand, again, is through group programs and individual programs, the government, in a certain way, was delivering a message: if you want to get ahead, you want to get a program, lie. The more you lie, the more you cheat, the more you don't tell the truth, the more you exaggerate, the more you get into an ethnic numbers game. You start off with 100,000 poor Jews, 150, 200, 300,000. There was a little noted schmarr maybe a year and a half ago pointing out that if we believe some of the more extravagant statistics, then the Jews end up being the poorest group in America, which is an absurdity. That was one thing that happened. That context is a communal context which affects our community. And our community was ripe for immoral picking, because we don't have a community, as we all know. We are a very, very small people. We are the same Orthodox Jewry, according to the population studies conducted by the Council of Jewish Federations and Welfare Funds. We are 10%, perhaps at most, of American Jewry. But this 10% is divided into a lot of so-called shtiblach, and I don't mean the real shtiblach, but the shtiblach of organizations, the shtiblach of neighborhoods, and the shtiblach of different kinds of alliances. And that meant that at the very least there would be a great deal of competition. And indeed, prior to the coming of programmatic competition, there were other kinds of competitions. For instance, in a listing of some of the problems that our community has faced in the moral domain, one could not ignore the fact that some of our organizations, which perhaps have a good deal more finesse to them, and certainly a great deal more sophistication about America, they're more English-speaking, etc., have indulged for a long period of time in the issuance of press releases, usually coinciding with events that they hold, that are totally dishonest. Absolutely, totally dishonest. And this filtered into a certain corruption involving for a decade or even more the New York Times, in which an organization would say, we are going to be sending rabbis into these communities, we're going to build this, we're going to do that, predictions of things not to come, and through a whole chain of events, getting things into newspapers competitively, which were totally dishonest. Fabrication. And fabrications, which were simply derived from the fact that it was felt that in order to endure in American life, this was the way to do it. So that was one kind of lack of restraint. And then in the more recent period, we have other things. Groups, in effect, competing for programs along the lines of other ethnic groups. But since we're not a united community, since we are a community literally which has hundreds and hundreds and hundreds, thousands probably, of parts, 400 day schools, and 1,000 Orthodox shuls in New York City at least, various neighborhood councils, and so on and so forth. Everyone was in the position to make Shabbos Chazir, to do whatever he or she or one particular group cared about, and that led to a great deal of corruption, as it still does. In particular, the problem has become most acute in the area of Chinuch, in the area of Jewish education, for reasons that are simple. Because it is here that you have institutions in Jewish life which are very, very costly, and whose costs expand every single year, and the level of philanthropy does not expand in a parallel fashion. And so what's happened is, very simply, that our day schools got into the active government programs, and then there certainly was a game as to whether you can you top this, as to exaggerating who you represented and what you need and what you did for the money, etc. Because there was no way for government to fund 400 yeshivas or 450 yeshivas, so it was a question of who would be most expert in various kinds of gamemanship and applicationship, and that would determine who would get what, when, here, and how, and so on and so forth. And this process continues today. In a sense, I believe that the programmatic and related corruption in our community is far, far greater than probably any of us can appreciate. Because given the split nature of our community, there's no way to keep up with all of the stuff. There was an article in the Reitz newspaper here some months back, in which a fellow complaining about a lot of things, including the new law school at Yeshiva and various other things, had seemed to have flipped out a lot of bad things from newspapers and was very adept at it. Perhaps some of you saw it. But what he clipped out was at best the tip of the iceberg. What is happening is far, far worse. On the other hand, we have a curious situation that, given the fact that everything is so splintered, that there's no doubt an opposite tendency to exaggerate things, in the sense that people will therefore believe that there are no honest people around, there are no honest Moises around, there's nothing good that is happening, which is wrong. But the situation is very bad, and it's bad because the general economic situation in New York City affects the Orthodox community most, certainly the very Orthodox part of the community, in the sense that we are more tied to New York than elsewhere. So people who are mobile, young college-age people, or people in their 20s and 30s, who are seeing no jobs in New York City, might pick themselves and go west, young man, young woman, or go to suburbia. Orthodox Jews are less likely to go to suburbia. They're tied to New York. They have an entrepreneurial tradition. If the entrepreneurship cannot lead to anything which is likely to be efficacious in the sense of ordinary businesses, they can become entrepreneurs in government programs, irrespective of Moses. So you have a very large number of situations today where people simply establish institutions as their devices for getting programs. That's their businesses. It's a very simple thing. Finally, as to what might be done about this. In the short run, very, very little. Very little is going to be done to change it, because we don't have a community. We don't have any constraint inside of the community. And yet, having said that, I believe that we at least have to, one, protest in a sense against this kind of conduct, certainly not congratulate people for it, certainly be a little more careful as to which people are honored by our organizations, which people are our heads. Second of all, I think, and this is a strand picked up, which Professor Wishenbrad mentioned, we have to stop learning speaking about Jewish ethics, particularly in the day schools, not because the day schools themselves are the conveyors for conduct often which is wrong, but because they are the places which our youth are being educated. Torah Mesorah, the National Society of Hebrew Day Schools, has a special obligation here, which I feel is not being carried out. We have to be more careful about rabbinical titles. If you want to play a little game, take the classifiers, the Yellow Pages in Brooklyn, and just count how many rabbis there are in Brooklyn. You have an Iyur Molid Rabbonim, according to Halacha. Thousands, probably several tens of thousands. And you know, you might think that it's good. You have sheep over there, and you got plumbers over there, and you got real estate agents over there, and you got businessmen of one kind or another, and you've got college teachers, and you've got accountants, and you've got lawyers, and you've got a smattering of government. People are really in the field. That is something that has to be addressed. The other day in Brooklyn, there was a situation, a New York Post reported it on out of Shabbos, in which apparently there was a holdup against people from out of the country, literally, who had a lot of cash with them. Rabbis held up. They're businessmen. And probably what ought to be done, since I don't think there's any process of restraining this, is for the Jewish community and the Orthodox community to go up to those telephone companies and say, the hell with the 50 cents a month, or the dollar a month, or the $2 a month. Pay a damn phone bill like everyone else pays it. So if there are 30 or 40 or 50,000 people out there like rabbis, sure 100 are going to be in trouble every year because that's the law of averages. But they don't have to be listed as rabbis. And we're not going to get people to restrain themselves, so get the phone company to restrain them. That's a communal thing. And it's a simple little thing that ought to be done. And finally, basically it's something we do in our own lives. We have to make individual decisions, as schmaltzy as it seems, as perhaps improbable as it seems, to simply, not merely live morally by oneself. That's easy to do. But the problem in any situation in a community which gets out of hand, whether it's racism or whether it's corruption, is that there's an intimidation against individuals who want to speak out against it. You're sitting in a room where you're with a group of friends and people are indulging in light talk, saying, well, you know, this goes on, and, you know, whatever the Shrops are doing, the Goyim do it, so the Goyim base is soil. That's our moral standard. That is where the battle is going to be fought. Don't be intimidated. Speak out, it's going to be uncomfortable. But when you fight against it, you will then have an effect on others. At least that's what I believe. Thank you.
I don't want to address myself this morning to what I would consider to be the black and white of ethical concern. I'll just give you a very brief incident. When I first accepted Rabbanus on the West Side, I was very interested in seeing what kind of kashrut supervision took place in the community. And there was a Midtown Board of Kashrus, West Side Board of Kashrus at that time, and I asked to meet with the Rabbi Machshir and Mashiach. The Rabbi Machshir had been dead for 2 years, and the Mashiach, Nebuch, had to go to the bathroom, and it took me about 10 minutes to guide him back and forth an area of about 20 yards. And he was responsible were upwards of 20 butcher shops. After a great deal of very, very hard work, the situation began to be righted, and there was one particular source of supply that we refused to give our permission to. This particular large supply house, probably the largest meat supplier in this section of the United States, had the hashgacha of a fairly well-known rabbi whose reputation was extremely many. We did not say we need to astray. We merely said that we could not endure as bad God. About 8 years ago, I received a call from an individual who introduced himself to me on the telephone as the lawyer of this particular abattoir. And he asked to meet with me. And he met me here at Alex's for lunch. My first mistake was that I allowed him to pay whatever the lunch bill was, $1.50 or $1.75 at that time, for two sandwiches. He got up and paid, and I went along. But during the course of our luncheon, I explained to him as well as I could that we were not stating that the abattoir was not kosher, but for various reasons, and I outlined them to him, we could not go along with their lachamash. His reputation was just too negative. Hence, perhaps if another rub would serve along with him, it might be easier for us. He seemed to understand. He had a car. He said, okay, Rabbi, I see that we don't agree. I'll take you home. We're going down the West Side Highway, and he says to me, you seem to know many of the young students. I said, yes, I'm already here at the yeshiva. Do you entertain them? I said, yes. On Shabbos, I generally have 2, 3, 4 Talmidim to my home. You must then have a very high meat bill. Yes. And believe me, I had the slightest notion what he was talking about that. He said, look, he said, it's about $30-$40 a week. That could be. We will supply you with meat every week. So I said, you don't understand. I just told you that our Midtown Board of Kashrus cannot accept your meat. He said, no, no, you don't understand. You will accept our meat, and we will supply you with meat every week. Now, I'll tell you what bothers me very much about music. Not that he tried to write. It could be if you offered me $50,000. Most of the lust. I don't know. I've never had that cash, so I can't tell you what I would do. What bothered me was, though, it's for $30 a week. He was asking me to keep up my integrity. And we were on 95th Street in the highway, and I said to him, you will either stop the car and let me out, or I'll have to open up the door of the car myself. What about a bus comes and offers a $5,000 contribution for a $7,500 receipt, and this has happened. When the Menahem of our Mesifta, Rabbi Bach, goes down to a local agency in the East Side to get money for food, and when the woman tells her, you will write that you have so many and so many students on full food scholarships, and Rabbi Bach says, but we don't have anyone on a full food scholarship, we have tuition scholarships, not full food scholarships. Just, well, you will write so many and so many students on full food scholarships, and it's the government employee dealing specifically with yeshivas. And of course, we had to leave without receiving any money from the government. And when certain decisions have to be made as to whom to honor and the manner in which individuals are being honored, these are issues which I believe are fairly straightforward. Hopefully, if there is a notion of Yiras Shamayim, and if these issues of Chesed are at least discussed and spoken about, because the tragedy within the Jewish community is that we can read the whole parshiyos out of the Torah, not by deluding them as the Reform do, but by simply not teaching about them, not speaking about them. There are Yichos Tzedakah. There's our whole Torah of Hosh Mishpah that we simply don't deal with. And we do teach the Zikin. We teach it on a highly academic level, not really on a very practical, ethical level. But if these wrongs can be righted, and if our educational institutions and if our synagogues will really teach ethics the way they must be taught, and if we can succeed in inculcating a feeling of Yiras Shamayim, I believe many of these problems will fairly easily be able to be handled. Easily, or with difficulties. Human nature raises tremendous difficulty, but at least we will be able to know your hand. I want to raise very briefly three ethical problems that plague me. The early problems, honestly, do not, mostly because I've never been really tested, but secondly, because I hope, I feel, and I hope everyone here in this room feels that the answer is fairly straightforward. There's an agonizing Gemara in Bava Metzia and in Pesach Beis. All of you know the basic Gemara. Tanu Shelach Noi, a clash between Rabbi Eliezer and the Chachamim as to the ritual purity or impurity of a specific oven. A baskol, a voice from heaven, which ultimately descends in favor of Rabbi Eliezer's position. Rabbi Gamliel, who is Dino, who insists, lo bashomayimi, the Torah is not in heaven. Yochid Barabim, halocha Barabim, you must follow the majority. What is agonizing about that Gemara is not the story itself of Tanur Shalakai. What's agonizing in that Gemara is the sequel to the story. The clash, not of right and wrong, but the clash of right and wrong. That which provides, at least me, with so much ethical difficulty, is all been having to decide between two rights. Rabbi Gamliel was right, because after all, the unity of the Jewish people was at stake. Rabbi Eliezer was right, because after all, he was perfectly intellectually and morally convinced of the correctness of his halakhic stand, and he feels that HaKadosh Baruch Hu will be absolutely further agreed with him. And the Gemara, the Agadot, in all of its profundity, understand the two rights. Rabbi Gamliel Reis Dino was right because HaKadosh Baruch Hu says to Eliyahu Hanavi, according to the Gemara, Bonai Mitzchuni, Bonai Mitzchuni, my children have conquered me, my children have conquered me. And Rabbi Eliezer was right because when he prays to HaKadosh Baruch Hu from the depths of his despair after he is put into Peirum, Rabbi Gamliel dies. There are two heroes which emerge from that afternoon, and two villains. And it's same two individuals, Rabbi Gamliel and Rabbi Eliezer. When does a religious leader take an unpopular stand and risk splitting the religious Jewish community, which is all too split to begin with? When must one be willing to accept chayrim for the correctness of one's position? And chayrim does not necessarily mean a public ban in a hotel room or in a base ledge. Chayrim can sometimes mean not being invited to the Brassical of the Sora Convention or not the Israel Convention, if that happens to be your peer group. Chayrim can sometimes mean, when your name is mentioned, people say, they can't follow us. The tragedy of ethical decisions which face those individuals who are in some way looked up to for Piskei Halacha or Halachic direction very often expresses itself in two rights. In problems like those which face Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Gamliel. And here there is very, very little within the Chosh Mishpat, within the Yoredeya, within the Orachayim, within the Eben Ha'ezer that can provide clear answers. A second ethical dilemma with which I must live, and I imagine others in my position must live every day in our lives. I don't think there is a term more pregnant with meaning has many nuances. And especially somehow within our goal, and within certainly the last decade in which I've been functioning as a Malabogam, I can cheer. Talmidim are desperately looking for direction. Young Talmidim as well as older Talmidim. How does one direct and not manipulate? How does one guide and not control? The Torah says, gracious, this is an expression of God's love. Merachepetz appears once again in the Torah in relation to the mother eagle and her eaglets. In the Midrash comment, Rashi quotes, the mother eagle encompasses her eaglets, but doesn't bear down too hard on them. And in that instant, when one can perceive how one encompasses but doesn't overbear, one perceives the deepest expression of love and concern. Professor Jean Borowitz has what I believe a very true and masterful piece dealing specifically with the ethics of leadership. The model which he uses is the Lurianic model. It's what HaKadosh Baruch Hu created the world, kaviyachol. It was a very difficult act of creation. It was an act of creation in which HaKadosh Baruch Hu had to leave room for worlds. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is pure spirit. HaKadosh Baruch Hu encompasses everything. How is there room for world in that act of creation? And the Ari HaKadosh explains that first HaKadosh Baruch Hu had to be mitzamtzein himself. He had to literally withdraw into himself in order to leave room for others. That the drama of creation, according to the Lurianic model, included a dialectic of tzimtzum and hispashtus, of withdrawal as well as expansion. That's true of a Rebbe as well. That's true of a guy as well. One must leave room for the individual development of one's talmidim. What else does the Mishnah in Avos mean when it adjures us, Ha'amidu Talmidim Harbe, enable your students to stand independently? It's easier to control and manipulate. Very often people come to a Rebbe wishing to be controlled. It removes from them a great deal of responsibility. And how to balance, how to orchestrate the legitimate role of Rebbe without which an authentic Jewish community cannot maintain itself, with the very clear necessity of enabling the Talmid, the student, to develop by itself. This is one of the deepest problems of religious leadership, to which I'm afraid we are giving all too little food. And thirdly, this motto of Tzimtzum and Hispashtus must relate to the leader as well. One cannot give out unless one has adequate time to put in. And within one of that Jewish community which is so bereft of leaders, the very few people whom we have are called on almost continually for very many important and worthy causes. And one can get up one morning around one of the sun and find that he has given so much that there is nothing left anymore. The Kutskinevo was once asked why he spent the last 20 years of his life in storerooms, completely alone, refusing to see anyone. He told a frightening story. He said, there was once an individual who lost his way in the forest right here in Sinai. And he saw a magnificent elephant, the most beautiful tusks he had ever seen. And he snipped off a little bit of the tusk, and he made from it a stuff box. He came to shul, and all of his friends were very excited, and they all asked him where he got such a beautiful stuff box. He explained exactly where in the forest the elephant was. 1 year later, he wanted another stuff box, and he went back to the same spot. But the elephant no longer had any tusks left, because everybody snipped a little bit for their own stuff. There is a tendency within the religious Jewish community to ease up its leaders. Part of the ethics of leadership must mean where and how to establish a Rishus HaYochid so that ultimately there will still be a reserve so that individuals can continue to teach because they are developing themselves. And only when the religious Jewish community demands of its leaders and gives them the proper opportunity to develop themselves, will they have the time to think through these very burning ethical issues, which will make certain the Jewish leader, in his drive to perfect the world, does not, Rahman of its life, lose himself. Finally, the beginning of Parshas Vizosa Rava, when Moshe Rabbeinu was about to leave the physical world, at a time when Moshe Rabbeinu lost the most important goal for which he had struggled during his lifetime, he was to die a failure before entering the land of Israel. He's called Yishuel Okim, translated by the Zohar HaKadosh as husband of God. Every individual has an external image and an internal image. His life can be measured in terms of what he does on the outside and to the extent that he develops himself on the inside. Only when religious leaders are at least as concerned with their own internal development as with the external development of the world and the Jewish community, perhaps only then will we get the kind of ethical directives that will cause a renewal throughout our people.
I arrived in New York and just got a look out the window and see what you see that met me in this city. There is a certain feeling of gloom about New York these days that makes national news. And I think that there is justifiably a feeling of gloom that really causes and has produced this group and this meeting. Just as one who has been involved, as Dr. Wishegrad said, in representing Orthodox Jewish causes, I can tell you that it is a subject of major concern to those of us who have been involved in this effort to see increasing problems of morality, increasing problems of lawlessness, that in some ways one might think a lawyer such as me is inclined to benefit from. I'm one who, unfortunately maybe, as a result of my profession, lives at least in part off misfortune. But like the doctors who are involved, surgeons who are involved in cancer research, or for that matter, in the care of that dreadful disease, it is obvious to me that I would much sooner be able to turn my efforts elsewhere, and that the ultimate solution of the problem, the ultimate disappearance of lawlessness, or the kinds of ethical concerns that give rise to this meeting, would be far better personally, professionally, and in the interest of the community. But I think our purpose here today is not to discuss the problem in general, but maybe to discuss specifically, or begin a discussion specifically, of what can be done with regard to this matter of substantial concern. Now, Rabbi Riskin, I think, began his presentation with a notion of general consensus, that we're all opposed to what would be black and white immorality, black and white violation of ethics, of corruption, of bribery. And yet, I think each one of us in the room today realize that the things that he spoke of in terms of black and white bribery or immorality is a phenomenon that continues to this very day. He says, Rabbi Riskin cited, for example, a matter of sale of honors of kibbutzim, of who becomes leaders and recognized recipients of awards in the Jewish community. And yet I think we all recognize that no matter how unlawful and no matter how much we may oppose and condemn that form of activity, nonetheless it continues within all our institutions, including, I might say, even our hosts, this institution today. It's a necessary phenomenon, I think, of modern Jewish life. Necessary only in the fact that it exists, that people are given tributes or given awards as a result of the fact that they either are able to provide financial support or in other ways are recognized as those to whom institutions may look to for assistance in one way or another. And yet we find that when the very individuals who are in that position are in some way receive notoriety in the press or in the public, we become concerned over the effect that this has on our community and over the impression it gives to the public at large. I came here today, really, with the intention of maybe giving you some specific reaction of mine to the fact that, or to the, as a result of the impressions I've gotten from being somewhat of a participant, as I think you're all aware, in the recent events that Rabbi Berman spoke about, and that have caused some concern within the community. I think maybe it would be useful, without getting down to specific instances, to talk about one or two ethical reactions that I would have as a result of the last few months of professional activity on my part, and as a result of reactions I've gotten from the community. I've mentioned to you, and I think Rabbi Rissman spoke about it, and Dr. Schick did too, this problem of honors being given by the community, those that it selects as its leaders. And what I think we've seen over the last few months has also been an indication of how the community reacts when those whom it is, for one reason or another, selected as a leader or as a subject of tribute, receives notoriety in the public media. And what has amazed me as a result of these few months has really been, to some extent, the double standard that the community, our community, imposes in these circumstances. Our leaders are selected by our institution. And it's our responsibility, not merely the responsibility of those leaders, but our responsibility to look after them, to look at them, to examine them, to make decisions regarding them. And in fact, it's a mitzvah I say, if in fact we see something wrong, to rebuke. Okay, that is an ethical obligation that we have with regard to those who are our leaders. What happens when those individuals become subject to public notoriety? The obligation of Topeia, and since Dr. Schick and Rabbi Rifkin have referred, and I think in this company is certainly appropriate, to Gemaras, let me refer to the Gemara in Sanhedrin, which says, Amar Rabbi Yochanan, Mipnei Mazacha Yerobam Lamalkus, Mipnei Shehokiach Eshlomo. Why did Yerobam ben Nevat, why was he selected as a leader? Why did he become king of 10 tribes? Because he rebuked Shlomo. But, the Gemara goes on, Mipnei Manenash, Mipnei Shehokicho Barab. Why did Yerobam receive punishment, not merely a minor punishment? Chazal tell us that Yerobam is one of only three kings who had no Pelech and no Olam Haba. Achav, Menasseh, and Yerobam had no Pelech and no Olam Haba. Malachim tells us about Jeroboam's punishment, about the death of his son. Chazal tell us about his being kotei matias harabim. Why did Jeroboam receive that punishment? Because what he did to Shlomo, who deserved Hokoka, was that he rebuked him, he condemned him, not in the way that our own ethics teach us should be done, but that he made him a subject of public scorn. Ethics, with regard to Jewish leadership, is not merely a one-way street. We look to leaders to lead us publicly and to do it ethically and to act properly. But the same pasuk, or the pasuk after the one that talks about Hokiyach, Hokiyach, Esami Sefa, the Torah tells us, Lo Sikon, Velo Sikon. You're not to take revenge. You're not to engage in the tira, which is a form of revenge. It's a form of saying, I'm better than you are. You, as I'll tell us what Nitzira means, is that if someone refuses to lend you an implement, an axe, and the next day he comes and asks for an implement from you, and you say, no, I'm not going to give it to you because you didn't give it to me yesterday. That's Nakama. What's Nitzira? Nitzira is when the man who refuses to lend you the axe comes to you the next day and asks for a saw, and you say to him, I'll give you my saw, because I'm not like you. You didn't give me the axe. That's Nitzira. There is an element in Nitzira of superciliousness, of self-righteousness. And my friends, as one who has been very much concerned over the increasing problem and the increasing problems that will come to our increasingly visible Orthodox Jewish community in the United States if, as it appears to be true, there are increasing instances of lawlessness, of corruption, I say to you that it is as ethically important to be sure that when we react to those instances, we do not do it in a way that either grows out of Nekama or out of Netira, but out of what the pasuk then goes on to say, Yahavta l'reyach kamoch. The basic problem, in the short time that we have to discuss it today, I think we can get down to all the causes or to a total discussion of what is it that gives rise to the problem. But certainly at its root is very much the failure of the Orthodox Jewish community over the years to recognize that in dealing with government, in dealing with governmental institutions in the United States, there is a religious obligation to deal properly. Now that's something, unfortunately, that our yeshivas katanas, and all the way up to the best institutions in the country, I think, our best institutions in the country, and I think that's true of this institution where we are today, do not adequately teach. Now that is a problem that is immense in its scope and how it is to be resolved is, I think, something that will have to be grow out of a continued evolution, continued discussion in meetings such as these, meetings of rabbinic groups, and meetings of organizations. I put to you the possibility that maybe one small solution is to reduce the level of institutional activity. As our community becomes more visible, and Baruch Hashem, I come up to New York these days, in the days that I was a student here, and you walked around the streets of New York, you very seldom saw people walking in the streets with yarmulkes. In my day, when I grew up in New York, kosher restaurants were few and far between. Now you have them of the Chinese variety, the Italian variety, and I don't know what else is opening up. McDonald's is opening. There's an immense explosion of Orthodox Jewish visibility. But with that, I think, comes increasing visibility of leaders and increasing visibility of those to whom the Orthodox Jewish institutions provide honor and tribute of one kind or another. And maybe, just maybe, if we can't form any internal mechanism for selecting out to who it is who is being given tribute to, and we have no internal mechanism for making determinations of the standards, the personal standards of behavior that every subject of honor and tribute actually has. Maybe a possible answer would be to reduce the economic needs that make this whole situation necessary. Why do we have to have multiple organizations, multiple banquets, multiple honors by all forms of institutions? And at the same time, I think, what we have to do when, in fact, someone who is a member of our community becomes a subject of public notice is not to react by what I could only describe from my own experiences appears to me to be almost a form of cannibalism, almost a form of turning upon and consuming one's own with, let me say, less in the way of knowledge, less in the way of familiarity with facts than people who know the facts have, far less. We, if our community becomes more visible, it also has to become less defensive. The fact that the New York Times may put something in print does not mean that it has to be followed the next day or the next week by a ringing declaration endorsing the truth of what appears therein, in what is in print, or because we're concerned about what the Guardian may say, a denunciation of whoever the object is of what appears in print. I'm not suggesting that what it does mean is unknowing absolute defense of our own people. But I think what it does mean is, at least according to those who, because of our own internal mechanisms, become leaders or people who are looked up to within our own community, at least the decency of giving them the same rights and the same privileges that we ask the outside world to give them and to give any other member of the outside world. I think those factors relate to ethics of a kind that this group ought to be concerned with. Those are ethics of condemnation and rebuke, not merely ethics of business, not merely ethics of dealing with government, but the ethics of what our society ought to do with regard to our own people. And it's really on that note that I think the time is time to maybe open up the floor to questions.